Copyright 2011, JKP, Radha Madhav Dham. All rights reserved.
Swami Nikhilanand is a disciple of Jagat Guru Sri Kripaluji Maharaj. He resides at Radha Madhav Dham in Austin, Texas, which is the U.S. ashram of Jagat Guru Kripalu Parishad. He travels America preaching the philosophy of Sanatan Dharma as taught by Sri Kripaluji Maharaj.
In this series, he incorporates all the main topics of the Hindu scriptures in a beautiful logical flow. The most prominent spiritual confusions of our time are addressed and resolved one by one as the series makes its way towards the culminating topic of bhakti and the path of God realization.
Yo Brahmanam Vidhati Purvam Yo Vaivedanscha Pranyoti Tasmai Tatvam Devam Atma Buddhi Prakasham Mumukshur Vai Sharanamaham
The divine souls will have a few minutes of Naam Sankirtan, and after that we'll hear the conclusion of this series and learn about the path of bhakti.
Yogi Dharma holy Vrindavan Bihari Lal Ki Jai.
This is the final day of this series, so I'm going to give a fairly comprehensive review of the main points that I've covered so far. As I told you on the very first day, this whole series is the explanation of one single mantra from Shvetashvatara Upanishad. Tameva viditvati mrityumeti nanya pantha vidyate anaya. Which means only by knowing him can he cross this. So he who must be known is Bhagwan, Brahm, God. He who must know God is the individual soul, all of us. And that which is crossed when you know God is Maya. So these three are eternal existences called eternal tattva. God is eternal, the souls are eternal, and Maya is also eternal. And this soul can cross Maya, but only by knowing God. It's the only way. There is no other way. This is the brief meaning of this verse. And the expansion of that, the expanded meaning of that, you've been hearing throughout the last 2 weeks. So, after briefly explaining the meaning of that verse, then I explained to you that I was going to prove that all souls are astik. It means every single soul believes in God. Even the ones who say they don't, they're all astik. And to prove this to you, I explain that every one of us is desiring happiness. That was the first step that we understood. Every single soul desires happiness, and happiness only. There's no other thing we desire, and certainly nobody desires unhappiness. Why do we all desire happiness, even though no one taught us to desire it? And every single living being, no matter how different we all are, we all share this one thing, that we all desire happiness. Why is it so? The reason behind that is that we are all ansh of God. It means we're a part of Him, and He is happiness. The word we use is anand. God is anand. So sometimes we say there is happiness in God, but it's not that there's happiness in God. God Himself is happiness, and we are a part of Him. So it is the nature of every ansh to desire his anshi. Thus, it is the nature of every soul to desire happiness, because God is happiness and we are his ansh. Thus, we've proven a couple of things. That every soul is ansh of God, and every soul is desiring God, which makes every soul automatically astik. Someone may say, I don't believe in God, or I don't want God, I don't love God. Well, do you love happiness? Everyone will say yes. Well, then you love God. Do you desire happiness? Everyone will say yes. Well, then you desire God. So you're automatically astik. But then I went on to explain the exact opposite, that every one of us is nastik. Because Ved says, Asti te vopalabdhavyas tattva bhavena cho bhayoh. Asti te vopalabdhasya tattva bhava prasidati. The moment you have full faith in God, He's standing there in front of you. So that right there is enough proof to know that we don't have full faith in God, so we're not astik. We don't believe fully in God, otherwise He would have come to us already. It means that although our soul is desiring God, our mind doesn't have full faith in God. So from deep down, our soul wants only God, but our mind has some amount of confusion and some amount of impurity, which prevents us from having full faith in God. So then we talked about the fact that Ved says you must know God. By knowing God, you'll get faith in God. Automatically, once you have faith, you'll love Him and then you'll attain Him. Then you can cross Maya and attain the divine bliss which God is. And you can enjoy that. You can receive that and have it forever. So how can we know God? Ved then told us, you can't know God. Although Ved also says you are a human being, so O human beings, you must know God now in this life. Not only did Ved say only by knowing God can you cross Maya, but only when you're a human being do you even have a chance to know God. So, on one hand, Ved is saying know God right now. Because without knowing God, if you don't know God in this life, who knows what will happen? Once you leave this body, you could be born in any other species, and it could be a long time before you get another human birth. So know God now. But then Ved turns around and says, no one can know God. But when we investigated this further, we found that what Ved is saying is no one can know God on their own through their own intellect. Because your intellect is material, mayic. So wherever it can go is all within Maya, and God is beyond Maya. So with your own strength of intellect, you cannot know God or grasp God. With your own material senses, you cannot perceive God, because they're material and He is divine. So it's beyond, He is completely beyond our reach. But then we learned that if you surrender to Him, He will grace you, then you can have His divine bliss, His divine vision. So you cannot know Him on your own. But if you receive His grace, then anyone can know Him. And His grace is only received by surrendering. There's no other practice or way of receiving His grace. You just surrender and He graces you. And that surrender is not a condition or a price of receiving God's grace. It's just a matter of He's giving His grace away for free, so open your heart and receive it. That's what surrendering means. So become just like a little baby, a newborn child in His mother's arms, is totally surrendered. That's how we have to become with God. We surrender, He graces, and that grace eliminates Maya. The effect of Maya on us, Maya still exists. So the effect of Maya is eliminated. We're freed from all of our past karma. We're freed from ever having to take birth again. And we're given unlimited divine bliss and divine knowledge. So how to become surrendered? We understood that surrender is done by the mind. So you have to surrender your mind. Then why can't we surrender right now? Having understood this much, it would make sense. Okay, become surrendered. But there's a problem. Our mind is already attached in the world, and we only have one mind. So we can't keep that mind attached in the world and with our other mind surrender to God. So the same mind that's attached in the world is the mind that we're trying to surrender to God. Therefore, it makes logical sense that we would have to detach it from here in order to surrender it over there, or attach it over there. In order to do this, we looked very deeply into the knowledge of what is this world. So we asked the question, why are we attached in the world? And the answer is that we're looking for happiness, and we believe that we will find that happiness from the world. So the natural consequence of that is you get attached. Wherever you repeatedly think there's happiness in this thing, you get attached. However many times you think it, that much the attachment grows. So we've done that millions of times, trillions of times in every lifetime, and we've had unlimited lifetimes from eternity until now. So we've built up a tremendous attachment in this world. And that attachment can only be reversed by understanding the truth that we were mistaken. There is not true happiness in this world. True happiness is in God. The happiness of this world is only in limitations, and it's always short-lived. It passes away and finishes, and then you have to look for something else. So that is not true happiness. True happiness, it's not only unlimited, but once you get it, no one can ever take it from you. It lasts forever. It can never be overcome or interrupted with any amount of pain or suffering. So that kind of happiness is not in this world. Understand that once and for all. And keep thinking about that deeply over and over again. As much as that goes into your mind, to the same extent you will become automatically detached from this world. It's a process. Keep thinking about that philosophy. You gradually become detached from the world and attached to God. Because naturally, if you're thinking, see, the same process works with God. How did we become attached in the world? By repeatedly thinking, this thing in this world will give me happiness. So if you repeatedly think, God is happiness, if I surrender to Him, I'll get perfect happiness, as many times as you think that, that much attachment you will develop in God. The next subject which came up was the subject of Guru, Mahapurush. That in order to complete this process of detaching from the world and becoming attached to God, we need the help of a God-realized saint, a Mahapurush. So we took up a few questions in this regard. First of all, what is a God, what is a saint, what is a guru? And the definition of a guru is someone who is Shrotriya Brahmanisht. Not only learned in all the scriptures and able to present it to us in a practical and understandable way, but also established in God Himself. The true guru must have attained God. Not even 99.9% of the way there is not enough. You have to be fully surrendered to God, God realized, free from Maya. Then you're considered a guru. So the guru has God's divine bliss inside, and he can give it to any soul who surrenders to him. So the guru gives us the correct understanding. The guru teaches us the path. What are we supposed to do? What practice should we do in order to become attached to God? What's the path to God? Guru answers our questions and confusions along the way, and also internally graces us, not only through his presence, but actually willingly, willfully graces those souls who are surrendered to him internally, which actually helps the soul reduce his worldly attachment and multiplies his love for God. This is all the effect of having a relationship with a true God-realized saint. We also understood that a saint cannot be recognized simply through any physical characteristic. Not by the way they dress. A saint, a God-realized saint, could wear ordinary clothes, could have a family, could be married. There's no rule that a saint can't be married. I gave you examples of Prahlad, Dhruv, the gopis, Arjun. These are all God-realized saints who had families. So you can't observe anything physically which could help you determine if this is a saint or not. I gave you a few ways that you can try to understand the saint's divinity. First, I told you what to avoid. A true saint never pretends to give any worldly blessing or boon. A true saint never curses anybody. All the stories we hear of saints cursing in our Puranas, that's part of a divine leela. So the saint is cursing another saint or something like that. It's part of helping that lila to unfold. A saint never curses an ordinary soul. And number three, a saint never makes an exhibition of any kind of power that he may have. And as far as recognizing who is a true saint, I told you you can recognize by the power of the saint's words, that they're not just empty words, they have a power inside that unties the knot of spiritual confusions which have been inside our hearts for lifetimes. Number two, you notice through the saint's association you're becoming more detached from the world and your desire for God is improving. And number three, you may get to see the divine love that the saint holds within his heart overflow sometime. It's very rare to see, but sometimes when a God-realized saint is doing chanting or talking about God's virtues or lilas, that ocean of divine love that he keeps controlled inside his heart may overflow, and then you may see some of the eight sattvic bhav. After that, excuse me, we took up the topic of the actual path to God. And we learned that there are only three paths to God. All the other paths and practices described in the scriptures are included in the path of karma, the path of jnana, and the path of bhakti. In regards to the path of karma, I told you that karma is not complete on its own, because karma means sattvic actions. So sattvic actions can only take you as far as swarg, but swarg is still under maya. Those who go to swarg are not God-realized, and they're not free from maya, and in fact they don't even get to stay in swarg forever. It's a temporary vacation, and then they come back here and start all over again as if they've never been to swarg. But if someone performs the same good actions with their mind attached to God instead of being attached in the world, that is called karma yoga. And karma yoga can take you to God, because the thing that takes you to God is the attachment of your mind. Wherever you're attached, that's where you're going to go after you die. So do all the good actions physically and have your mind attached in the world, you'll be reborn in the world. Do all the good actions physically and have your mind attached to God, you will go to God. That's karma yoga, as opposed to just karma. The attachment to God is in fact bhakti. That's what bhakti means, having your mind attached to God. So it means that karma is not independent from bhakti. Karma is dependent on the path of bhakti. We learn the same thing about the path of jnana. If someone follows the path of jnana, first of all, it's very difficult, because to even qualify to start the meditation of the path of jnana, you have to be totally renounced from this world. Imagine, before you even start. On the path of bhakti, however attached you are in the world, you just start, and gradually your attachment reduces and your attachment to God increases. But on the path to jnana, you have to be totally renounced before you can even start. So it's a very high qualification to begin. Once you do qualify and you're following the path, you have no protection of God's grace, because the formless God which the jnanis worship, it's the same God, Ram, Krishna, that we worship, but the impersonal aspect of God does not grace. So the jnani has no protection on his path. If his mind deviates from his path and starts desiring the world, he'll fall and he'll lose hundreds and or even thousands of lifetimes of effort. In the end, the jnani also has to surrender to a personal form of God. Why? Because to get beyond maya, you need God's grace. So the jnani cannot get liberation without God's grace, so the jnani must also do bhakti. Just as the karmi needs to do bhakti, the jnani also needs to do bhakti. then he becomes a gyan yogi. Yogi meaning the one who has joined his mind with God. So when the gyani surrenders to God, then he knows God. And with that knowledge, he is liberated from Maya. But after all of this effort, the gyani still has not attained the same thing that the bhakt who worshipped the personal form of God attains. So I gave you some examples of gyanis who, after attaining liberation before they left this earth planet, they received the bliss of the personal form of God, which made them forget about formless God forever, and they never went back to that formless bliss. And they surrendered to the personal form of God and drowned themselves in His love forever. So it shows that the bliss of the bhakt is beyond the bliss of the gyani. The bliss of sakar brahm has something special that the bliss of nirakar brahm is bereft of. You get a personal relationship with sakar brahm that is not experienceable with nirakar brahm. That's what the gyanis desire, and that's what the bhakt saints get. So this brings us to the third path. Let's understand in depth about the path of bhakti. This is the path we have to do. I explained that to you at the end yesterday, that all of the scriptures say no one can attain God without bhakti. If you want to observe physical good actions along with your bhakti, that's fine. If someone wants to worship formless God along with surrendering to the personal form of God to get His grace, in other words, he's doing gyan along with bhakti, okay, that's fine. Or just do pure bhakti. That's what I'm going to explain to you tonight. What is the path of bhakti? Bhakti is of two kinds, siddha bhakti and sadhana bhakti. What is siddha bhakti? That's our ultimate goal. This is something very great, which is in fact the greatest thing in the divine world. Let me give you a little bit of background, because this is our goal, so we should understand correctly, what is it? What is it that we're trying to attain? Vishnu Shakti Para Prokta Kshetra Gyakhya Tatha Para Avidya Karma Sangyanya Tritiya Shakti Ruchyate. Vishnu Puran. This shloka says, although God has unlimited divine powers, satyam jnanam anantam brahma, Ved says, God's powers are unlimited. Everything about God is unlimited. But out of all of those unlimited powers, three are main. What are the three main powers of God? They are called His parashakti. It means His own personal power. That's supreme. Parashakti. It's also called Swarup Shakti. That's number one. Then, other than Swarup Shakti, he has two other main powers. Jeev Shakti, that's us. All the individual souls taken together are his Jeev Shakti. And then he has Maya Shakti, the power he uses to manifest the universe. These are his three powers, three main powers. Swarup Shakti, his personal power, that's the power that is God's own personality, you can say. Through Swarup Shakti, he is all-knowing, all-powerful, all-blissful, omnipresent. In addition to Swarup Shakti, he has Jeev Shakti, all of the souls, and Maya Shakti, the material power. Now, Chaitanya Mahaprabhuji says, Sat Chit Anandamaya Krishnera Swarup Ataeva Swarup Shakti Hoye Tinarup Anandan Sheh Ladini sadanshe sandhini, chidanshe samvit jare jnana karimani. God is Sat Chit Anand. Everybody has heard this definition of God. He has three qualities: Sat, Chit, and Anand. Three aspects of His personality. So since God is Sat Chit Anand, His personal power, Swarup Shakti, has these three aspects: Sat aspect of Swarup Shakti, Chit aspect of Swarup Shakti, Anand aspect of Swarup Shakti. So the Anand aspect of His personal power is called Ahladini Shakti. You might have heard of this term. Ahladini Shakti is His power of divine bliss. Through this power, God remains all blissful in all the situations. So Ahladini Shakti is the Anand aspect of His personal power. The Chit aspect is called Samvit Shakti. That's His power of divine knowledge. Through that power, God is always Jnanamay. Through His Ahladini Shakti, He's always Anandamay. And the Sat aspect of His personal power is called Sandhini Shakti. This is His almighty power, Aishwarya Shakti. Through this power, He is all-powerful. There is nothing He can't do. Vishnu Puran also mentions the same thing. Ladini sandhini samvitvayeka sarvasanshraya ladata pakari mishra tvaino gunavarjite. God's three aspects of His Swarup Shakti are Ahladini, Sandhini, and Samvit. Now, out of these three, Ved says, Tasvahladini Variyasi. Ahladini Shakti is supreme. Because, I explained this earlier to you, much earlier in this series, that Sat and Chit are included in Anand. So, Anand is supreme. Thus, the Anand aspect, Ahladini Shakti, that is supreme. So that is God's supreme power. But it doesn't stop there. Ahladini Shakter Paramasar Taro Premanam. The essence of Ahladini Shakti is Prem. And another word for Prem is Bhakti. So when I say Siddha Bhakti, I'm referring to that divine love power of God. Which is what? That Prema Shakti, or that Siddha Bhakti, that divine love power is the essence of God's Ahladini Shakti, which is the essence of His Swarup Shakti, which is His supreme power. So in other words, there's nothing beyond God's divine love power. That's the supreme power in the divine world. There's an interesting story which points this out, which is told in the Ramayana. When Bhagwan Ram offered a boon to Kag Bhushundi, he said to him, Kag Bhushundi Manguvar Ati prasanna mohi jana animadik siddhi aparnidhi moksha sakala sukha khan. He said, Kag Bhushundi, I'm very pleased with you today, so I'm prepared to give you a boon. Anything you want, I'll give it to you. And then he made some suggestions. Why don't you ask for untold wealth more than Kuber? Why don't you ask for the great yogic siddhis, great powers of this Maya? Why don't you ask for moksha, liberation? Kag Bhushundi didn't want any of these things. He said, if I must ask for a boon, if you're prepared to give me anything, I don't want any of the things that you're holding out in front of me and saying, why don't you ask for this? Why don't you ask for that? He said, I want the thing you're keeping in your back pocket that you're not openly offering me. What's that? Avirala bhakti vishuddhatava shruti purana jehi gava jehi khojat yogi shumuni prabhu prasad ko upav. He said, I want avirala bhakti. It's a different word for siddha bhakti, that supreme divine love power I described for you. He said, that's what I want. Now, why is Ram keeping that in his back pocket and not openly offering it to his dear devotee? Veda Vyas says as much. He says, muktim dadati karhi chit smana bhakti yogam bhagavatam. Krishna is very quick to offer mukti, but not so quick to offer that divine love power, siddha bhakti. Why not? Because once he gives that divine love power to his devotee, the tables turn. Right now, we're the ones asking for his grace. Once a soul receives that divine love power, what happens? Aham bhakta paradhino hyasvatantra ivadvija sadhu bhirgrasta hridayo bhaktair bhakta. Then he becomes subservient to that saint. Imagine, the saint cries tears to receive God's grace, and if he is wise enough, when God comes to him and says, what do you want? And he says, I want your divine love. And God gives that, then God becomes under that saint. Anubrajamyaham nit Yam puye tyanghirenubhi bhagavatam. Krishna says, those saints who have received my divine love, I follow behind them like a servant, following to see, is there anything I can do? What can I do for you? And he says, in addition to that, so I can receive their foot dust on my head, because when they walk, some of the dust from their feet will fly up in the air, and if I'm following along behind them, some of that may fall on my own head, and I'll be blessed by that. I'll be purified by the dust of their lotus feet. So this is what happens only in one case, if you ask for his divine love. So that is our ultimate goal. That is that divine love, which is God's supreme power. If you receive it, what happens? Naraji says, Yat prapya nakinchit vanchati nashochati nadveshti naramate no tsahi bhavati. You never desire for anything ever again. You never feel any feeling of enmity or dislike or hate for anyone or anything. You never feel a lack. You always feel whole and complete. Yallabdhva puman siddho bhavati amrito bhavati tripto bhavati. You become perfect. You become completely satisfied, yet your satisfaction does not make you complacent. It's not like, okay, I'm satisfied, so my bliss stays at this level. No. He says, pratikchana vardhamanam. It goes on multiplying. So even though you're full and complete with that divine love you received, you still desire to see more of Krishna. So your love goes on multiplying every second. And you yourself become the form of divine love. Just like God is the form of bliss, you become the form of bliss. Amrito bhavati. Tat prapya tadeva avalokayati, tadeva chintayati, tadeva shrinoti, tadeva bhashayati. After that, you see only divine love, divine bhakti, you hear only divine bhakti, you speak only divine bhakti, you think only divine bhakti. That's it. So how is that divine bhakti received? Tulsidas ji says, Yah guna sadhana te nahi hoi, tumhari kripa paav koi koi. You cannot attain that divine bhakti through any kind of sadhana. There's no practice, there's no path that you can say, okay, I'm going to do this and at the end the reward will be divine love of God. There's no such path. Then how do you receive it? Prabhu prasad ko paav. If you receive His grace, you can get His divine love. Narad ji says, labhyate chatat kripayaiva. Only through His grace can you receive His divine love. So, when is He going to grace us with His divine love? Vedavyasji says, bhaktya sanjataya bhaktya. You have to do bhakti to get His grace. What I thought bhakti was the divine love power that we can only receive through His grace. No. There's another kind of bhakti you have to do. So there's two kinds of bhakti. Siddha bhakti is the ultimate divine power. You get that through His grace. But to receive His grace, you have to do sadhana bhakti. So by doing sadhana bhakti, what happens? Our heart is purified. Our antahkaran is purified by doing sadhana bhakti. When it's fully purified, remember I told you, at that time the guru can grace you with divine power, not before. So first you have to do sadhana bhakti, fully purify your antahkaran. Then guru will divinize your antahkaran. Then what? Then He gives you siddha bhakti or prema bhakti, it's also called. So one bhakti we have to do. By doing that bhakti we purify our heart. In other words, we become patra. Our mind and heart become a fit receptacle for that divine power. God or Guru cannot grace anyone with that divine love power until first they do bhakti, purify their heart, then get their heart divinized by receiving Swarup Shakti, then into your divine heart you receive Prema Bhakti. So we have to do sadhana bhakti. Therefore, we should understand how to do sadhana bhakti. The bhakti we have to receive, let's leave that aside for now, that God is going to give us when we're qualified. So how to become qualified? Do sadhana bhakti. But sadhana bhakti is not done just any way. In fact, there are quite a few conditions which have to be followed in order to do sadhana bhakti properly and successfully. So Bhagavatam mentions a few. Mano gatira vichinna yatha gangam bhasom budhau lakshanam bhakti yogasya nirgunasya hyudahritam ahaituki ahaitukya vyavahita sa bhakti purushottame. Rupa Goswami mentions many of the same ones. Anyabhilashita shunyam jnana karma dhyanavritam anukulyena krishnanushilanam bhaktiruttama. And Naradji mentions the same conditions. He says, gunarahitam kamanarahitam pratikshana vardhamanam avit chinnam sukshmataram anubhavarupam. So what are these conditions? Number one, the word nirguna. That means no desire, either tamas desire, rajas desire, or sattvic desire. It means not asking God for any tamas thing, rajas thing, or sattvic thing, and not even asking Him for mukti. That's nirguna. Number two, ahaituki means having selfless love for God, which means unconditional love for God. I love you, it doesn't matter if you love me back. That kind of love, which is not seen in this world. Nobody loves like that in this world, but these scriptures are saying that is real bhakti. If you have love for God like that, that I'm going to keep crying tears for you, longing for you to come to me. When you come to me is up to you. Even if I have to keep crying tears for thousands of lifetimes, I'm not going to give up. And I'm not even making any, I won't get frustrated. You come, it's up to you when you come. That's ahaituki, selfless devotion. Number three, abhyavahit, which means no bhakti ke upar karma yog gyan ka havi nahi hona chahiye. In English, that means bhakti is independent. You don't submit bhakti to the rules of karmakand. You don't submit bhakti to the rules of yoga or jnana. Bhakti is independent. Everything else is dependent on bhakti. So you do bhakti and forget everything else. Or if you're doing anything else, it's subservient to bhakti, not the other way around. You want to follow some rules of the Vedas, of karmakand, fine. But that's subservient to bhakti. Bhakti is not subservient to the rules of karmakand. Number four, bhakti is practiced through four bhav. Loving God as He's your master. Loving God as if He's your friend. Loving God as your own son. And loving God as your divine beloved. Number five, bhakti is practiced with ananyata, which means tvameva mata chapita tvameva tvameva bandhuscha sakha tvameva tvameva vidya dravinam tvameva tvameva sarvam mam deva deva. It means, you alone are mine. It means we love God only. We don't worship celestial gods, various devi, devatas. We worship God only. And by worshiping Him, we know that everyone else is satisfied and happy automatically. So our mind should be attached only to God, not in this world. That's ananyata. Nowhere in any tamas area, rajas area, or sattvic area of the world. Number six, bhakti should be nirantar. It means continuous, all the time, unbroken. It means you should, if you love God, you should love Him all the time, 24 hours a day. Number seven, bhakti is practiced with the mind. So you must do Rup Dhyan. You must see the form of God, visualize the form of God before you while you're doing bhakti. And number eight, Kusanga Se Bachana, avoiding the effect of bad association that damages your devotional feelings. These are eight main conditions on the path of bhakti. To fully explain all of these conditions so that you would understand all the aspects and how to apply it in your life, I need a whole maybe 7 to 10 days more. So with the time I have left today, I'm just going to cover three of these conditions in a little bit more detail. The first one, not having any desire from God. Nirguna. Desires are of two kinds. Bhukti and mukti. Rup Goswami says, Bhukti mukti sprihaya vatishachi ridivartate. If either of those demonesses is present in your heart, pishachinis, If either of them is there, which ones? The desire for bhakti and the desire for mukti. If either one is there, bhakti mahadevi will not come and reside in your heart. It means true feelings of bhakti will never grow in your heart until you banish the desire for bhakti and banish the desire for mukti for good from your heart. Then real bhakti starts to grow. So what is bhakti? It means desire to find happiness from this world. We covered that in so much detail already that I'm sure you can understand. When there is no happiness in the world to begin with, why keep asking God for something that's not going to satisfy us anyway? Yat prithivyam vrihiyavam hiranyam pashavastriyah nalamekasya paryaptam tasmat krishnam parityajet bhagavatam. Even if someone were given all the gold, all the women or men, if you're a woman, all the power, all the wealth of this whole earth planet, would he be satisfied? Would she be satisfied? No. Why? What would happen? Jasa jasa surasa badan badhava ta sudugun kapirupa dikhava. Just like the competition between Surasa and Hanumanji. She made her mouth bigger to try to swallow him, so he doubled the size of his body. So she made her mouth as big as he was, he again doubled the size of his body. That's what goes on. Go on asking God for worldly things, and even if he went on fulfilling your every desire, your desires would just go on growing. There's no end to it. Whatever we could imagine to ask God for, we've already gotten and enjoyed. We've lived uncountable past lives. We've been Indra uncountable times. What to say of ruling this world? So why keep asking Him for the same things that we've already gotten and never satisfied us? Number one. Number two, if God is really going to answer your prayer, you really have that faith that God, I'm asking you for this thing, so give it to me. Why not ask Him for the thing that would put an end to your asking forever? Ask Him for divine bliss. That's unlimited and you'll never need anything ever again. So that's the goal anyway, isn't it? If someone is praying to God and asking for worldly things, it means as of yet he hasn't even understood the goal. So how far is he going to get on the path? Understanding the goal comes first. So this knowledge comes first. There is no Anand in this sansar. Anand Bhagwan mein hi hai. Bhi nahi, he. That knowledge comes first. Then you start on the path. So if someone is praying to God and asking for worldly things, it shows they're not even qualified to take the first step on the path of bhakti. Another point to consider is that we're all subject to our destiny. So the things in our life come and go up and down along with our destiny. Avashyameva bhok. Tavyam kritam karma shubha shubham. Vedavyasji says, everyone has to undergo the effects of their past good and bad actions. There's no way around that. So an intelligent person, a wise person, undergoes the effects of his destiny with calm, understanding that this is happening due to my destiny, due to my own past good and bad actions. Then why should we pray to God about those things that cannot be changed? Even God will not interfere in those things. We must undergo the effect of our past good and bad actions. What is destined must take place. So God does not interfere in someone's destiny. When Krishna himself didn't save Abhimanyu from getting killed, he didn't interfere. What had to happen, had to happen. Then why should we think that he's going to interfere in our destiny? So when we pray to him, we deceive ourselves by thinking, oh, I prayed for that thing and I got it. Why did you get it? Because it was already in your destiny. God will, or if you want to believe God gave it to you, okay, God gave it to you according to your destiny. And if it wasn't in your destiny, He wouldn't have given it to you. So, something good happens, right? When that happens, your faith improves. I asked God for it and I got it. But then, as many times as you get it, probably an equal number of times you won't get it also, because some things may not be in your destiny. So then your faith in God will reduce. Eventually you may even become Gnostic. You may stop believing in God that, oh, I only had one child. My neighbor has 10 children and he just had an 11th born to him. And my only child died at the age of 7. I prayed to God and He didn't save him. Then faith in God is gone. So this is not a stable way to do devotion. Therefore, the wise approach is to just decide, I'm never asking God for any worldly thing ever again. He knows what's right for us according to the spiritual laws. He's omniscient. Who are we to tell Him, God, I need this thing, or God, I need that thing? Just have faith in Him, surrender to Him, and leave the rest up to Him. So, when a person makes this decision, I'm never asking God for any worldly thing ever again, now he's ready to take the first step on this path of bhakti. So we don't ask him for bhakti. Chaitanya Mahaprabhuji says, Na dhanam, na janam, na sundarim, kavitam va jagadish kamaye, mama janmani janmani shvare, bhavatad bhakti rahi tuki tvai. Oh Krishna, I'm not asking you for dhan. I'm not asking you for jan, which means I'm not asking you for a family or friends or a big following. Na kavitam va. I'm not asking you, I don't want to become a great poet or a great writer or a great artist and get name and fame in this world. What do I want? I just want to be surrendered to your lotus feet. Janmani, janmani. Life after life. It means, look at that, he's not even asking for liberation. He's saying, you can make me keep being born in this world. I don't mind as long as you give me devotion to your lotus feet. Nanaka prishtham nacha sarvabhaumam na parameshtyam na mahendra dhishnyam na yoga siddhira punarbhavam va vanchanti yat padaraja prapanna. Bhagavatam. A person who really has true bhakti, even if he were offered the seat of Brahma or Indra, he would turn it down. He would say, no thank you. Just like Kagbhushundi. Even if he were offered the seat, even if he were offered the 8 great yogic siddhis, even if he were offered to be the ruler of this entire earth planet, even if he were offered liberation, mukti, he would turn all of them down because he only wants to have devotion to God's lotus feet. So, see, not only does a true devotee not ask God for bhakti, he does not ask him for mukti either. And in fact, asking for mukti is worse than asking for bhakti. Surprising, right? Because if you ask for bhakti, you'll remain in this 84 lakh yoni. You'll keep going around birth after birth. Eventually, after who knows how many births, you may get a chance to be born as human again. And when you're born as human again, you may get a chance to meet a true saint who may give you correct understanding. Having received that correct understanding, maybe you'll do bhakti and not ask God for bhukti or mukti, and you'll attain His divine bhakti. That's possible if you remain in this world, even if you're in the field of bhukti. But if you ask for and receive mukti, you merge into formless God forever. And then that devotion to His lotus feet that those saints were asking for, that's finished forever. You became one with formless God, never to experience anything ever again. So it means you remain bereft of that sweet relationship that you can have with the personal form of God. And I already gave you many examples of jnani saints who were liberated, who decided that I want the bliss of the personal form of God instead of this formless bliss. So if you ask for mukti, you don't get that supreme divine power, bhakti, which brings God under you. You remain bereft of that forever. But if you get that bhakti, bhakti karati soi mukuti gosai an ichhit avat bariyai. See, karma is under jnan. Jnan is under moksha. Moksha or mukti is under God. And God is under bhakti. So if you get bhakti, you get God, and you get moksha. If you got God, moksha, jnana, karma, everything comes along automatically. So you don't even have to ask for mukti. You get liberated without even wanting it, without even asking for it. Mukti comes to you with folded hands and says, I'm here for your service. And the bhakt says, get away from me. I don't want any mukti. I want bhakti. But nonetheless, the bhakt gets liberated, but he doesn't finish his personal identity by merging into formless God. He gets to maintain his own identity. It just becomes a divine identity, and he stays with God in the divine world forever. So now we understand shart number one, not asking God for bhukti or mukti. This is the number one condition on the path of bhakti. And probably, out of all of them, that's the first and foremost one we have to understand. Now, there are only two more I'm going to tell you about briefly. One is that, since you're not asking God for bhakti or mukti, how should you relate to Him? Well, you can ask Him for His divine vision and His divine love, but you should have the feeling that He's yours. How is He yours? Adopt one of four bhav. I mentioned them briefly earlier. Those bhav are called dasya bhav, sakya bhav, vatsalya bhav, and madhurya bhav. It means loving God with the feeling that I'm your servant and you're my master. Or loving God with this feeling that I'm your friend and you're my friend. We're like best friends. Or vatsalya bhav. You're my own son. I love you the same way I would love my own child. Or madhurya bhav. I love you as my priyatam, as my own divine beloved, the same way I would love a beloved in this world. So loving God with one of those four bhav is also a condition of bhakti. Because if you think of God as God, then the love gets restricted because God is almighty, all-knowing. How could, just like a subject would never think of having a personal relationship with the king, if you think of God as God, it means there's some restriction in how you're going to feel towards Him. So to remove that distance, remove that restriction, we adopt one of these four bhav. So when you think of God, don't think of Him as God. Think of Him as my master whom I get to serve, or my friend that I can talk with and play with and be with, or my own child that I can hold and love, or my own divine beloved, which includes all of those feelings. So adopt those feelings into your bhakti. And the final shart, which I'm going to elaborate on a little bit here today, is that bhakti must be done with the mind. Bhakti man se karni hai. Man se. You can understand why, I'm sure, since it's our mind we're trying to purify so that we can qualify to receive His divine love. So, we have to do bhakti with the mind. Doing bhakti with our hands won't purify our mind. So the physical aspect of bhakti, whether it be puja or arti, or singing God's name, or visiting a holy place, or physically coming to a temple, or doing pat, all of these physical aspects of bhakti cannot purify our heart. It's our mind that has to be surrendered to God. It's our mind that has to become attached to God. So if all of those other physical aspects of bhakti help us do that, then good. Use them. Yena kena prakarena mana krishne niveshayet. Our scriptures say any way you can attach your mind to Krishna, do it. But remember, the attachment of the mind is main. Manera smarana prana. The prana of bhakti, the soul of bhakti, is your mind being attached to God. That's the main thing. Everything else is like the body. See, like compare the importance of your soul compared to the importance of your body. If your soul leaves your body, what is the value of your body? Zero. People pay money to burn it to ashes. They want to get rid of it that badly. So the body without a soul has no value. So the soul is the main thing. In the same way, the attachment of your mind to God is the main thing. That's the core of bhakti. Everything else is just the decorations along the way. Everything else is a helper. So if doing kirtan helps you attach your mind to God, do it. If doing puja, pat, visiting holy places, if any of these things help you attach your mind to God, do it. But whatever you're doing, always remember God first. So that's why, what's the first thing we do in bhakti? Rup dhyan. Dhyan means remembering. And rup means the form. So, you're sitting to do some kirtan. What do you do before you even say the first word? Rup dhyan. You imagine Krishna before you. Or whatever form of God you're worshipping, imagine that form of God before you. Now you're doing rup dhyan. If you remember anyone in the world that you love, you think of their form, right? So think of God's form before you do any kind of bhakti. Think of His form. You start with rup dhyan. So the rup dhyan is the prana. And then doing kirtan, puja, pat, anything else, jap, whatever you may be doing, that's just the physical helper that's supposed to help you do rup dhyan. Now someone might wonder, I've never seen God, how can I meditate on His form? Well, isn't it possible to desire something that you've never seen before? We desire so many things that we've never seen before, just hearing from someone else. We hear a nice description by someone of, Niagara Falls. So beautiful, you have to go. Okay, next time on the next long weekend, I'm driving to Niagara Falls. See, you desired Niagara Falls before you saw it. Let's say you're a young girl growing up in a village and your mother shows you a photograph of a beautiful, handsome boy your same age. And your mother says, this is the boy you're engaged to. You haven't met him yet, but you'll get married to him when you get older. So she keeps that photo of that boy. She's never met him. Her love is already growing, and she does a Rup Dhyan of him. Oh, he's so handsome. She thinks of him in her mind. She's doing Rup Dhyan. So we have the same thing with Krishna. We have the same thing with Ram. Those saints who have met Ram and Krishna and the other forms of God, they have given us detailed descriptions of what they look like, and on that basis, artists have made paintings and pictures. So we can use that for our Rup Dhyan. Someone might think, but wouldn't it be easier if he came to me just once? Ek baar dikhao jhalak. Then dekho main kaise Rup Dhyan karta hun. No, it doesn't work that way. I explained to you already that we've seen him thousands of times in past births. We didn't recognize him. Jaki rahi bhavana jaisi prabhu murati dekhi tin taisi. Our mind and senses are all material, so even if God came to us right now, okay, I'll show you myself one time, then you can do Rup Dhyan. We'd say, what? That's God? He looks like an ordinary person to me. So we don't get the benefit of seeing him until we're qualified. So in fact, what we're asking him to do is, give me the reward before I do the work. Give me the degree before I enroll in school. Give me the fruit before I plant and tend the tree. It doesn't work that way. We have to do the work. We have to do Rup Dhyan. So the Rup Dhyan is the core of sadhana bhakti. The other conditions that I described, those are just things that you have to keep in mind. But the actual practice, the thing you have to do, Rup Dhyan. So don't ask God to come to you first. That won't help you. Based on the descriptions of the saints, we can form an image of God. But how is it possible that we'll get a divine result out of our material meditation? Go go char jahan lagi man jai so sab maya jane ubhai yato vacho nivartante aprapya manasa sah ved. In other words, wherever your mind can go is all maya. Your mind is made of maya, so wherever it can go is all within the mayic field, and God's roop is divine. So with our mayic mind, how can we imagine God's divine form? His form is divine, not material. So if you form an image of Krishna, you're forming a material image of Krishna. Are you actually imagining his divine form? No. Then how can he grace you with his divine vision when you're only imagining his material form? Because he's gracious. He knows you can't imagine his divine form until you get a divine mind. So he graces you, he rewards you for your effort and your intention. Your intention is what you're rewarded for. So when you close your eyes and think of him, in your mind you're thinking, this is real Krishna. I'm just going to imagine him to the best of my ability and imbue divine feelings in it, that this is real Krishna. No matter how good or bad my imagination is, it doesn't matter. This is real Krishna right here in front of you. So according to your bhavana, he's going to grace you. So you do get rewarded, even though in this stage your meditation is material. It's okay. He's going to grace you with his divine vision anyway. So this is the practice, Rup Dhyan. Okay, I'm ready to do Rup Dhyan. What do? Where should I go? Where should I sit? What time should I do it? So there's no actual place that you have to be to do it. There's no rule like, oh, I'm in a dirty place, so I can't do Rup Dhyan. Because you're doing it in your mind, it's not like a yajna, where it can only be in pavitra sthan. There are rules like that for karmakand, not for bhakti. So you can be anywhere, but it should be a place where you won't be disturbed. That's the only condition. As long as you won't be disturbed, you can be anywhere. How to sit? Brahma Sutra says, Asina Sambhavat Achalatvam Chapekcha. You should sit alertly, but there's no particular way that you have to sit. You don't have to cross your legs in a certain way. You can stick your legs out straight in front of you if you want. Why? Because God's in here. You're doing Rup Dhyan of God with your mind. It doesn't matter where your feet are pointing, how your legs are crossed, you don't have to hold your fingers any particular way. It makes no difference. It's like loving someone that you think of in this world. Do you have to sit a certain way to remember a loved one in this world? Is there a certain time of day, only that window, where you can remember your beloved child or your beloved spouse? Or you have to have a bath before you think of them? Or only when you sit on a certain type of asana you can remember them? No. So there's no such rules in bhakti. Na desha niyamastasmin na kala niyamastatha. There's no restriction of time or place, or even that you have to bathe first. That's all for karmakand. You're doing Rup Dhyan. It's in your mind. You can do it anywhere, anytime. So no restriction of time or place or how you sit. If you fix a regular time to do it, it might help you do it every day, so you could take that into consideration, but it doesn't have to be at a specific time. Okay, so what do I do? Two things. You can, first of all, think that Krishna is coming to you. This is Milan. So what do you do for that? You imagine his beautiful form. Whatever part of him you can imagine is fine, and you can use all of your senses. If you can't imagine visually very well, then just feel his presence or smell the fragrance of his divine body or his banmala. But if you're visual, you can imagine all his decorations. He's got a mild smile on his face. He's looking right towards you, and he's coming, and he comes right towards you, and you come, and he gives you a big hug. Imagine that with a million different variations. So he came from behind me and put his hand on my shoulder. He came from behind me and I heard the jingle of his anklet. Any different variation you want, this kind of Milan Rup Dhyan. Or you can change it to Viraha Rup Dhyan. Oh, he hasn't come to me yet. When is he going to come? Please come. You're begging him to come to you. It means you're developing your longing. If you develop this longing, tears will come eventually. You'll actually feel so much desire to meet him that tears will come. This is viraha meditation. Those tears have to come, actually. They're tears of longing. They're also tears of repentance and humbleness that you're mine and I never truly desired to meet you before. I stayed attached in this world for so many lifetimes, ignoring you, but you never forgot me. Those are tears of repentance, tears of humbleness. So when those tears come, that's the true sign of bhakti. Katham vina roma harsham dravata va cetasa vina vina nanda shrukalaya shuddhed bhaktya vina shayam. Krishna himself says to Uddhava in the Bhagavatam, he says, how can your heart be purified unless it melts when you remember me? How can your heart be purified unless when you think of me you feel a thrill and the hairs stand up on your body and you get goosebumps? How could your heart be purified unless when you think of me tears of longing come in your eyes? This is real bhakti. So today I've been able to explain to you some of the most important aspects of the path of bhakti. There's a lot more to understand, as you probably understood from the beginning when I named all of the other conditions, which I wasn't able to elaborate on today. But what I've told you is enough for you to get started. Remember not to ask God for bhakti or mukti. Establish a relationship with Him in your heart with one of those four bhav. And then do Rup Dhyan. Once you're doing the Rup Dhyan, you don't have to do it in silence. Tulsidas Ji says, and all our scriptures say, the best sadhana to add in with your Rup Dhyan is Kirtan. Kirtan blocks out external distractions, because if you're trying to do Rup Dhyan in silence, any little movement, noise from outside, all of it is going to distract you. If you're doing Kirtan, all of those distractions are blocked out. Even if you just put a CD on and put your headphones on, whatever Kirtan by any saint you like, Surdas, Meera, Kripaluji Maharaj, any Kirtan that helps you develop your own feelings. So the Kirtan helps you focus, it keeps you awake, because you will fall asleep doing Rup Dhyan if you're not doing Kirtan. Within 5 or 10 minutes, you all have stressful, tiring lives. You'll sit and you'll think Krishna's coming. Krishna's coming. Aage. But if you're doing Kirtan and you're singing out loud and even clapping, that will keep you active. Then you'll be able to do Rup Dhyan for longer. And also you can sing different kinds of Kirtan. It will keep you from getting bored. So you can do the meditation for longer periods. So this sitting, when you're away from the world and you're doing Rup Dhyan and you're doing Kirtan, that is your karma sannyas. You've taken sannyas for that time. You're completely away from the world and you've devoted that time to God. The rest of the time you do karma yoga. You remember Him throughout the day. Remember He's always with you. You're never alone. Just take a break from whatever you're doing periodically throughout the day to remember, oh yes, He's here with me. And feel that feeling of relationship with Him. That's your karma yoga. You're doing your duties in the world, in the family, at work, but you're always remembering He's with you and He's yours. And He's the goal of your life. And then at least once a day, if not twice, sit and do Rup Dhyan and Kirtan, or any other sadhana that you like to do, but Rup Dhyan must be there. And if you practice that, you'll see results. Not right away, your mind will wander in the beginning. Nothing in this world ever came easily. You had to practice. So if you sit tomorrow and you say, okay, I'm going to do Rup Dhyan, and your mind wanders, don't get frustrated. It takes time to clean out some of that dirt, build up that attachment to God, then the meditation becomes easier. So practice. Try to remember and apply what I've shared with you this week. And if you want some help to maintain what you've gained this week, I can give you a few options. First and foremost, there's an invaluable book called Prem Ras Siddhant, upon which this whole series was based. Prem Ras Siddhant is written by my Guruji, Jagat Guru Shri Kripaluji Maharaj, and each chapter was one of the speeches that I gave this week. So you can get that book online, or you can get it from Rohit, who's sitting in the back. I think he has a few in his car. So taking and reading that Prem Ras Siddhant when you're on the subway, or when you have a few minutes free in the day, that's the best thing you can do. In addition, you can listen to the Hindi speeches of Kripaluji Maharaj on television every day. We have a flyer here that has the timings. He's on TV Asia every morning and Aaj Tak every night. In addition to that, we have an ongoing satsang here in New York. We have it at different devotees' homes, Tuesdays, Fridays, Saturdays, several times throughout the week. So if you'd like to come and join in, although it's at a private home, it's a public satsang. Any of you are welcome to come and join in. So make sure that we have your email information and tick the box saying you'd like to receive weekly emails, and then you'll know where the different satsangs are, and you'll also stay in touch. You'll know when I'm in New York and when I'm not. But whether I'm here or not, those satsangs go on. You watch a speech of Kripaluji Maharaj, practice Roop Dhyan and Kirtan, do the Aarti, get to meet other people who are following this path as well, get to come close with them. And finally, I'd like to give you one other option that you can pursue, which is coming to our ashram in Austin, Texas, Radha Madhav Dham. Visit our website, radhamadhavdham.org. You can learn more about staying overnight there at the ashram. And probably the best time to come is during the family camp. The next family camp is December 26th to the 30th. And of course, that's during the kids' holidays. So it's a great time to travel and come out and have a total experience of getting education of Sanatan Dharma, plus having a lot of fun, plus doing bhakti and meditation and kirtan, and doing it all within the ashram itself, so that you don't have to worry about cooking, cleaning, nothing. You're on a spiritual vacation, and even your kids are taken care of most of the time in their programming. So you really get to enjoy your time there and get a lot of benefit. The last thing I want to say is that just a reminder that all of the audio files, the MP3s of each day from this week, are available online. And if you want us to email the link and the password to you where you can access those MP3s, and even you can listen to them online or even download them onto your computer, give your email information here and we will send you that link. Tomorrow's picnic that I've been announcing, it looks like it's being threatened by rain, but we're still going to have it, and we'll see. The rain's supposed to clear up. I don't trust the weather people. I mean, it may be cloudy and not rain, so if that's the case, we'll still have the picnic. And tomorrow I'm going to speak a little bit in the park about doing worldly duties without attachment. This is one worry that people have, that if I attach to God and I detach from the world, mere sansar ko kya hoga? Will my world just fall apart? So I'm going to explain to you that you're better at doing your duties with less attachment. So I'll speak on that. We'll do some kirtan, have some question and answer, and then we'll have lunch and play some games. We're supposed to start at 11. So we'll start with kirtan and my talk, and then we'll have lunch and the games after that. So there's a flyer for the directions to Sands Point for those of you who would like to join us. So that concludes this whole series, and hopefully I'll be able to return, and next time I'll focus more just on the path of bhakti, and we'll go into a lot more detail with that. Jai Shri Radhe. Ek bhajan kare? Theek hai, theek hai. So while we do this bhajan just for a few minutes, you can try practicing Roop Dhyan. Remember, either Milan or Madhuri, either one is fine. And visualize the form of God that you wish to meet. Govinda, 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 Radhe, Radhe, Govinda.
Radhe Radhe Govinda.
साकेत बिहारी श्री राघवेंद्र सरकार की जय।
One other thing, my next public program is going to be at the Hindu Center in Flushing, September 4th to the 11th. And there's a flyer here that will tell you all the topics, what each day is going to cover. Jai Shri Radhe. Yes.